The following program has been furnished and paid for by Nathan P. Ross, CPA, and KSCB and KGBC are not responsible for its content or the products or services offered.
Welcome to the Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA, a show that helps you learn how planners can generate significantly more wealth now. Nathan will answer your questions about business or personal finance or how to increase current cash flows and generate retirement savings to make sure you're on the right path and so much more. Whatever your financial goal, Nathan can get you there faster. And now, here's your host, Nathan Ross.
Okay, welcome to this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA. We're glad you can join us once again. And before we get started, I just want to remind you that as we're talking about certain investment opportunities or tax strategies, pretty much any other content, please don't accept it as something that you should run out and experiment with. Let's let you talk to your existing advisors, legal, accounting, tax, real estate, etc., and make sure that they agree, assuming they're aware of your facts and circumstances. I certainly hope they would be. They can decide whether or not you understood correctly what you thought you heard and whether or not it actually is something that might benefit your reaching your goals and objectives. It's been a while since I did a live show. I think, maybe the last three have been recorded. Sorted tax deadlines and other things that kind of got in the way, but I think I'm back on track to continue to do some live shows for a while at least. And I don't really relish having an extra hour over here in Southeast Asia to do so, but, we don't do daylight savings over here. It's another reason that I point to when I talk about how practical the Thai are here in Bangkok. And every time I turn around, I realize, this really does have some things that are just commonsensical better than what we try to do in America. And I guess starting to see more and more people in government acknowledge that, hey, do we really want to do daylight savings time? And I've lost track of all the arguments. All I know is it gives me an extra hour to sleep in the morning before my call stream starts with clients and prospects from America. But conversely, it's a two-edged sword, because instead of the show on Friday that we do 11 p.m. for me, because we were 12 hours ahead of you, now it's 13 hours, so it is midnight here, just after midnight here in Thailand. So I've got some coffee in hand, and I'll be prepared. It's kind of a, one of the things we talk about, let me back up. I first advise you, consult with your advisor without telling you, and I know this is true, what I'm getting ready to say, because I get phone calls that prove it out almost on a weekly basis. If you don't have advisors that understand real estate taxation married with real estate private partnerships. Partnerships are a very complicated area under the tax code. And then you throw the real estate rules that overlay those into the mix. And then you consider the effect if it's being undertaken through some of your retirement funds. And then you also look at whether or not you've chosen to execute. We hope you will. The zero tax bracket strategies, or zero tax rate, I should say. There is no zero tax bracket. But when you have all those rules jostling about, for position, it does become something that's maybe not necessarily every CPA wants to focus on. And, you know, I know as a young CPA, you know, we thought we could do everything. Got a manufacturing company? Great. We know manufacturing. Got a retailer? Great. We know retailing. All those rules. And, you know, once you've been around the block a few times, I've been practicing now, I hate to admit it at times, it's a blessing and a curse, I suppose. I've been practicing north of 40-plus years, you know, in the CPA, the tax space. And I'm not apologizing for it, certainly. I think it's part of what makes wisdom at times is having been around the block a few times, whether it's doing what I do or likely doing whatever you do. So, but anyway, that said, I can tell you that the depth at which we go into each of those areas I mentioned is far more than superficial. So, you know, if you're looking for someone that understands those areas, and maybe you're contemplating real estate private partnership syndications as an example. It's coming back. We've had some tough past two or three years, and now there's huge opportunities coming into the market because of the calamity that's been to date. It's been pushed back. Banks are reticent to write down loan values, or I guess they do write them down, but they try to avoid writing them down, to the less extent possible. But all that apparently is finally coming to a head. And I know we've mentioned several times, more than several times over the last year, year and a half, that, hey, now's the time that the, for want of a better description, the blood will be running in the streets from all the foreclosures that should occur here very near term. And, you know, the ability for banks to continue to cuddle their problem loans has reached a point where it's not going to be acceptable. I guess the regulators are probably putting the most heat on them. But that creates opportunities. And you know, the basic model of how we make money with multifamily investments, which differs significantly from single family, and we'll talk about that here shortly, but with multifamily, the basic model is that we buy typically a, for want of a better word, a beat-up old Class C apartment complex. We make it beautiful. We renovate it, in other words, update it, put the new amenities in it that you would have if you were buying a new Class A, and I'm talking about things like smart home packages, bark parks for the dogs, maybe some covered parking or garages, media rooms. I mean, I can't even think of everything because there's a long list of little subtle, some not so subtle amenities that help these Class A operators get the rents that they do, even though their rents have gone down, rent amount, monthly rent. They've kind of held strong as of very recently, and I think Houston especially, maybe more so, certainly more so than Austin and San Antonio. Houston's got, it looks like a pretty bright outlook here near term. In any event, once we've renovated the older property, brought it up to market in terms of the amenity set, at that point we're able to charge more rents, which the higher rent collections drives an increased net operating income. That has gone up as a result. And now you're in a position to either refinance that property with the lender or maybe even a new lender, depends on terms of your original debt, and pull money out that can be passed back to the partners. And, you know, I know over the last 20 years we've seen situations where 100% of partners' capital was able to be distributed upon refinance, and certainly, you know, 40 to 60% more often occur. And I will acknowledge the leaders of the syndications now, the lead partners or, excuse me, or sponsors or syndicators, they probably, from what I can tell, they're either overcapitalizing a bit because they've just had their hands burned in some situations from the rising interest rates that happened within the last year, year and a half, or 2 years. And so now they're extremely cautious about having some reserves. So if something changes again as quickly as it did, and by the way, I'm not sure if you remember, there were 11 such rate increases that the Fed increased. I guess it's the Fed funds rate that drives the other interest rates, 11. And even the best syndicators out there that may have purchased rate locks to give them some protection didn't anticipate the need to go up as high as the interest rates actually happen. So in any event, you know, the same basic model still applies, but maybe with some modifications to avoid the calamity that much of the market has seen as of late. Let's do this. We're right on top of our first break here. Let's go ahead and take that break, and then we'll circle back momentarily with more of this week's Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.
Hey, if you'd like to contact Nathan for questions during the show today or during the week, you can text him at 713-782-1900. That's 713-782-1900. Or you can send an email to Nathan at npross.com. That's Nathan at npross.com.
BeAPlanner.com wants to ask you, when's the last time your tax pro called with a way to save you taxes? Seriously, do you want to work with a planner or a reporter? A planner knows which tax code sections are the best wealth accumulation tools. Less tax, more profit. Learn more at BeAPlanner.com. The Be A Planner Show with Nathan Ross.
My name is Corporal Bradley Joseph Seitz.
Jerry Reed.
Kate Weber.
These are real veterans facing a real challenge.
I have PTSD.
And I have PTSD.
I have PTSD.
Post-traumatic stress disorder can happen to anyone.
I was still in a war zone in my mind.
But treatment can turn your life around.
Treatment has really saved my life.
To learn about PTSD and how treatment can help you, call your local VA medical center or visit ptsd.va.gov.
Dr. David Mobley is on call.
The purpose of the show is take your calls and chat with you about your health care.
The Houston Methodist Health Hour.
And I want you to join me, talk about your health issues or somebody that you care about, something you've heard, something you've read, something you're curious about. I may or may not have an answer, but I'll give it the best shot that I can.
The Houston Methodist Health Hour, Monday and Tuesday afternoons at 1 on The Voice of Texas.
For 250 years, our armed forces have bravely served America. Wounded Warrior Project honors that legacy by supporting post-9/11 service members and veterans like Anthony, a Marine who was injured by a roadside bomb in Afghanistan.
They carried me through my injuries, not just my physical, but my mental. And seeing other vets doing the same thing helped me tell myself, hey, you can do this.
Join us in honoring warriors at woundedwarriorproject.org/America.
Is it easy? No, it ain't. Can I fix it? No, I can't. Well, I sure ain't gonna take it lying down. Will I make it? Maybe so. Will I give up? Oh, no. I'll be fighting till I'm 6 feet underground. I'm gonna woman up and take it like a man. I'm gonna buckle up, be tough enough to take control and make it.
Okay, welcome back to more of this week's Be a Planner show with Nathan Ross, CPA. And as we were discussing in the first section of the show, the way we make money with multifamily apartment complexes. And I got up to the point of where we refinanced to pull some of our capital out. Without selling, and potentially you may be able to even sell if that's the best option under the specific circumstances. Sometimes that is a good option, and you know the idea is necessarily we don't hold an apartment building for X number of years. Intentionally, we may end up holding it a number of years, but we're looking at the value of that asset and more the value to others than the value to us. In other words, we want to take advantage of a rational sales offer and then take the capital and in most cases go buy something even bigger or even more lucrative, generating more net operating income, more cash flow. Cash flow is the name of the game with these types of assets. Whereas, let's look at single family for a moment. The single family rental game, if you want to call it that, is markedly different. We're not looking at necessarily we do, of course, want to buy a cash flow generating asset. Don't get me wrong. However, you're not quite as able to affect the value of a single family property. You may affect the cash flow a bit by renovating it, but the problem is you've got an overall cap based on the area of a given property that you're going to be constrained with. And that's, not just with respect to renting that property. You don't control your next door neighbor's house or neighbor's houses. And so you're pretty much limited by what is all around you. Not that it's not totally the case with multifamily that you would control that, but let's just say there's more of a community within that 200 or 300 or 500 unit apartment building that you can affect. That said, you do have to consider the overall neighborhood, because if you think you're going to buy a D or maybe even a C minus multifamily property, and it's in a neighborhood that is part of the reason it qualifies as a D or a C minus, the odds are, even after renovation, you're not going to be jumping up a grade or two on the class of the assets. You may be able to go from a C minus to a C plus, or maybe a D plus to a C, but you've got limits, and it's based on everything that it's based on the neighborhood. Let's be frank. It's based on the people that live in the neighborhood. What type of people are involved? Is it workhouse or workforce housing? Is it professionals? That all has an impact directly or at least indirectly on what types of homes and rental dwellings you might buy for either apartments or for single family. However, the biggest issue with single family is that to make money on the increase in value, you're probably looking at holding that property for a while, because we don't gauge the value or assess the value of single family based on net operating income like we do with apartments. And that's why we can buy an apartment building that's, you know, 40, 50, maybe more years old and focus on how do we elevate the bottom line. And we do that through amenity upgrades, some management issues. You know, if you take a swimming pool that's constantly a mess and clean it up and maintain that, that might help. Again, putting in some upgraded flooring and things of that nature can help. But bottom line is that net operating income is what an investor or a lender is going to look to when they apply a cap rate or an ROI or assorted other measurements to decide whether or not to refinance your loan, or whether if it's a potential buyer, how much they're willing to pay. Whereas with a single family property, you're capped pretty much at the comp of your neighbor three blocks away that sold their house 2 weeks ago or 2 months ago, maybe even as much as 2 years ago, depends on the area. And that's going to dictate how much you can sell yours for. And so it's a totally different market. And I'm going to suggest to you, and I've got clients that make money both ways, and some of them at the same time. Some of my single family clients, or some of my clients that own single family, are also invested in the private real estate partnership syndications with apartments. So, you know, I'm not saying one is better or worse for all the reasons involved, but I'll say that multifamily tends to fit those of us that are not wanting to be hands-on with the real estate. And I don't mean necessarily you don't want to get the phone calls about toilets and roofs and other issues. What I mean is you don't want to have to go get the loan to acquire the property. You don't want to have to hire staff, you know, contractors, maintenance folks, leasing agents, just go down the line. You don't want to be bothered with any of that. All you want to do is invest your money with a creditable person, the lead partner, and you would like to get some checks coming in as soon as the property is producing the cash flow. And I'm going to underscore that. I have watched for many years these transactions since, I don't know, at least the early 2000s. So 20-plus years in my practice, I've dealt with either the syndicator, the lead partner, and or the passive investor. I know both sides of that equation. As an investor, I know both sides. I own an 8-unit property in San Antonio that's in a hot area now. For those of you that may not have noticed the news this week, on Tuesday, the citizens of Bexar County, including the city of San Antonio, voted affirmatively to move forward with the new sports and entertainment district that's going to be located downtown. I'm sure if you've been to San Antonio, you're aware of where the Hemisphere Tower is, and that general area. You know, we had, and I emphasize had, the Institute of Texan Cultures, ITC, right on the corner there, a massive Texas museum, or museum of all things Texas. Well, that building is no more. It was being demolished even before the vote. I think the Spurs and the city had a good idea. That's San Antonio Spurs, for those of you that are NBA fans. And yes, I know they've lost their last two games. But prior to that, they were 5-0 and hadn't lost a game since last April. So, you know, we expect them to lose some games. Unfortunately, they had both of the last two in their clutches and let them get away. But anyway, bottom line is there's going to be a new Spurs arena right there at the corner of I-37 and Cesar Chavez, where the ITC sat. And then in addition to that, the convention center there is going to be massively expanded, 220,000 approximately square feet, where it'll be a tier one convention facility, much like Chicago or Vegas, or I guess even Orlando. It's in the top tier. And then as part of that expansion, there's a new 1,000-room hotel that'll be constructed. Numerous restaurants and other retail will be on the 62-acre site. And the former federal courthouse that is also on the Hemisphere side is going to be returned to an amphitheater as it was originally constructed for the 1968 World Fair. And then the last component is there's going to be a massive land bridge built over the I-37 freeway or expressway that cuts through downtown. But that land bridge will connect the Alamo Dome to that activity. And, you know, it'll be the Alamo Dome and the new Spurs Arena, or the new Sports and Entertainment District, will share parking as a result, and the Alamo Dome will get approximately $100 million renovation as well. Again, I think we've done that two or three times now. But bottom line, it's an exciting time for people that own real estate as I do. Everything I own, condos and standalone commercial building and 8-unit apartment complex, is located within 5 blocks of one side or the other of that 62-acre site. So we're excited. The time is right, and we were already in a good area for selling the pieces of real estate that we have. We're both, my business partner and I, are getting old. Okay, not really. I'm 65. But I feel old, and it's just a good time to have some options. And I think selling the real estate is time, a lot of it. We'll see what kind of values we can get. But in any event, the fact that I've invested in a group partnership, passive and hands-on, as much as I need to be from living overseas. I understand the nuances, and I can tell you, if you're, you know, past, I don't want to say past your prime, because let's face it, the older we get, we don't tend to retire as much as we refocus. And I'll continue to talk about retirement as refocusing. And But, you know, the ability to manage real estate is more of, I'm going to say it, it's a younger person's game. And not to say that, you know, hey, if you enjoy being on call with your properties and you're 80 years old, hey, go for it. I've got clients that are in their late 70s that still manage their own single family rentals, and my hat's off to them. I can tell you, I don't feel like doing it. And that's why I sold the ones we had more than a few years ago, because it just wasn't fun anymore. And I'll take the multifamily, even owner, where I own the whole building or whole property, is less intense, because, you know, you hire out, you've got, you know, a roster of contractors that pretty much take care of the property. In any event, we'll go ahead and discuss. I wanted the hot topic right now in the discussion within the government and the Democrats and the Republicans and the various constituencies is the ACA subsidy discussion. And for those of you that aren't aware, that's been given as the reason that we can't get the government restarted. The Democrats are wanting to extend the subsidies. You remember, these are the subsidies that we needed to allow the medical system, the apparatus, to adjust where we'd have all the savings that were going to result from the ACA, which, you know it, I know it, and the American people knew it. If I can borrow a quote from Bob Dole, the great senator from Kansas, used to end every speech with, you know it, I know it, and the American people know it. And it was a great exclamation point, usually, on whatever he was discussing. Did we ever really think the cost of our health care was going to come down under any circumstance? I didn't. I'd watched mine over the 40 years previously go up 3 times, and each time there was some new financing option that supposedly was going to reduce the cost, and it did temporarily. I remember when even the ACA, and that would be the Obamacare is the synonym we used, it went down. Yeah, and so did the difficulty in getting health care. No, nobody has health care unless you have time and money, period. And it's turned out, and lucky for me, good timing, Nathan, on getting old, I was able to sign up for Medicare April of this year. And it's incredible to me how Medicare system, if you go back in time, I know at some point within the last 20, 25 years, if you went into your doctor's office, the odds are they would have a sign on their counter saying, we don't accept Medicare, or we're no longer taking on Medicare patients. And how times have changed, how the worm has turned, as the case may be, the old expression, where it seems to me the medical service providers are welcoming Medicare. And that's one way, I guess, to cut the time factor involved, depending on which flavor of Medicare you want to sign up for. You know, you can avoid the gatekeeper apparatus if you do one with a supplement plan, I believe, and maybe that's not even the criteria. I know there is that option, and having been exposed to that in the recent past before I was on Medicare, I can tell you, huge time waster, as are various other rules. I know over here we don't need a prescription from a doctor to go buy the common medicines. I mean, there are some that require it, but they're few and far between, and it's typically more of a situation where they should be controlled anyway. But, you know, I don't know about you. I've taken amoxicillin and a number of other doxycycline, I believe. Even my blood pressure medicine, I've taken it for 40-plus years. All those, I could just go to a pharmacy anywhere in town. And the wise thing to do is carry one of the pills with you to show them exactly what it looks like, just to be sure. And you can buy as much as they have in stock. And there's none of this time wasting of figuring out who your gatekeeper is, going to that person who may or may not be able to prescribe medicine, depending on what the issue is. It may take a specialist. And, it's amazing how, the world has cycled back around to where the Medicare model is preferred as opposed to being shunned. But in any event, so the ACA subsidy discussion, what are the subsidies and how are they structured? And I'm just going to give you some highlights out of this article that the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, that's the CRFB that we've talked about often on this show, supposedly bipartisan think tank that analyzes new tax legislation, budget deficit matters, etc. Excuse me. Logan. Beginning in 2014, the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, established exchanges where individuals like myself without employer-based health insurance can purchase health insurance. Within the exchange, the ACA established income-based subsidies to partially cover premium costs for many enrollees. Subsidies are based on premiums for the second lowest cost, quote, silver, end quote, plan called the benchmark plan. I wasn't aware that that's what it was based on. I've never gotten a subsidy, but I've known people that did, and that's interesting. I think the silver is probably the last one that I had before I got on Medicare. Enrollees receive subsidies equal to a fixed share of income and pegged to the benchmark plan, with the fixed share of income rising with income. Makes sense. Between 2014 and 2020, and starting again in 2026 under current law, subsidies are paid on a sliding scale basis to those with incomes between 100% and 400% of the federal poverty level, which is a function of income and household size. Most of those with income below 100% of FPL are eligible for Medicaid in most states. Under current law, the 2026 subsidies will limit the premium enrollees' pay for a benchmark plan to 2% of household income for those making 100% of the FPL. And it rises to 6.6% of income by 200% of the FPL, and 9.96% of income between 300 and 400. So bottom line, those subsidies were set to continue in 2026. The American Rescue Plan Act and Inflation Reduction Act, however, the American Rescue Plan Act and the Inflation Reduction Act increased the ACA subsidies temporarily from 2021 through 2025. These enhanced subsidies cover the full cost of a benchmark premium for those between 100% and 150% of the poverty level. Beyond that, the subsidies limit the premiums enrollees pay for a benchmark plan to 2% of income, 2% of income by 200% of the poverty level. 6% for the higher amount, et cetera. So bottom line is now, so let's see, the next little section here is how much do the ACA subsidies cost and how many people do they cover? Okay, well, this is where the rubber starts to hit the road in terms of why the Republicans have reduced, if not eliminated, a chunk of that subsidy. It says ACA subsidies are primarily paid directly to insurers throughout the year and then reconciled through tax returns, taking the form of income tax credits for individuals. The gross federal cost of these subsidies and related spending grew from $18 billion in 2014, the first year in which individuals were eligible for subsidies, to $50 billion in 2018. My, oh, my. It's the same old significantly increasing annual medical costs. 4 years, it tripled, literally tripled. Actually, I take it back. That was in 2 years. It grew to $92 billion by 2023. So let's see, that would have been 9 or 10 years. So on average, almost $10 billion a year. The net federal cost of these subsidies is somewhat lower due to less federal spending and tax breaks related to employer-sponsored health insurance and uncompensated care. The growth in ACA cost over time, and again, none of this was supposed to happen. I remember the rhetoric. We start off with, well, you can keep your doctor. Well, apparently not in many cases. And then medical care is going to get less expensive because we're spreading it out across, you know, more people. And I guess maybe it got less expensive per person, but it didn't reduce the amount of the expenditure. And I don't recall it ever. I mean, I wasn't a big user of medical services, but I sure don't remember thinking, oh, man, this went way down. Or this is like Thailand. never thought that. Let's see. I need to skip ahead here. We're running out of time. How much does it cost to extend enhanced subsidies? The enhanced subsidies in effect this year are scheduled to expire at the end of this year, reverting to the original ACA subsidies. Well, you know, that's some common sense, but it doesn't deal with the fact that medical care, the costs have gone up so high. The Congressional Budget Office, estimates that extending the enhanced subsidies in full would cost $350 billion over a decade. So let's see, based on the numbers, based on the numbers I was just reading, 2023, it went up to, let's see, let's just say the difference between 2025 and 2023 is about 30% higher. So that's just 25. 24 and 25 are roughly, I don't know, it looks like about 25% and then 30 to 35 on the graph that they have here. And then, of course, all this, for the most part, it's all deficit financed. So it's not money we've got sitting in the bank that we can just pull out of the pocket and pay for. Let me get down. Okay, let's look at just trying to see if there's any discussion about how far apart we are amongst the two parties. Yeah, there's not. There's other articles I've seen come through, but I'm gonna stop this discussion here. We'll probably deal with it again next week, because I think it's important to understand, because this has got a huge impact on the deficit, which in turn impacts taxes, obviously. And when you look at the fact that the 28 or 29 fiscal budgetary cycle is when we have eclipsed the remaining part of the discretionary piece of the federal budget, and this, I believe, would fall into that. I mean, it does in one way. It may not technically meet the definition, but it does in that we don't have this dialed in right now into the OBBBA, the big beautiful bill that was passed recently. So it would be a new type of tax. But in any event, let me see. I had another article since we're talking news that I wanted. Let me see if I can. This topic that I am going to mention as briefly as possible, since we're down to the last 5 minutes or so, is I'm sure you've seen ads on TV about title and deed theft. And I don't know if, you know, any of my listeners have been exposed to that. I don't think I've got any clients that have, but, I know from talking to the title company I utilize that they seemingly are going out of their way, because as this article points out, and this article is on it's actually a Kiplinger article. I'm sorry, I was thinking it was Globe Street. They've got an article from, let's see, when was this put out? Well, it was back in August. It looks like, that was the last update. And it's the same thing you see on the commercials on television. Imagine waking up one day to find your name erased from your deed, or worse, your house sold out from under you. That's what happens, and it's on the rise. It's a real phenomenon, and it's a rising threat, and it sounds crazy that a criminal, a crook, as they call him in this article, can forge documents to steal homes or secure fraudulent mortgages. So what typically will happen is first they'll get the deed in their name, then they'll go find a lender who does the, quote, normal due diligence, I guess. And I still don't understand. I guess dealing with a title company repetitively like we do is probably a good idea, because then you've got a little bit of a history on, you know, your properties, that hopefully another title company would notice something awry when it comes up, because, you know, there's going to be a chain of title, I guess, is what they call it, that would show it going from you to whoever the criminal was. And, you know, I think that there's some descriptive language involved on those title policies that would help clue another title company involved that was going to offer a new title policy. I mean, you got to understand, title policies are a real, I mean, it's a genuine risk for a title company when they issue a title policy. And let's say somebody's paying at closing, usually the seller would pay for it, $1,500 to $5,000 probably would be the bullseye to have that policy. Well, you know, you may end up paying off on a several hundred thousand dollar or more house. So they've got their due diligence. And you would think that that would be enough of an incentive. But nonetheless, there is a huge increase. Seniors are the biggest component of that target. So we'll talk more about this on future shows, because I think this is important to, I know it doesn't have anything to do with private partnerships, but it's something that's serious. Okay, well, we're at the end of the show. I've got a little bird in my ear telling me, my producer. And we appreciate you tuning in, and we will be back Sunday, possibly with one of our cyber security and AI themed shows. And we hope you can join us here on KSEV AM 700 or AM 1540 AGBC. Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and join us again next week for another edition of Be a Planner Show with Nathan Ross, CPA.